It's May 2nd. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
For those of you joining us for the first time, humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on science, reason, and compassion.
Or as the Chamber's Pocket Dictionary puts it quite nicely, in our opinion, humanism is seeking without religion the best in and for human beings.
Well, we're back from the New Humanism Conference, which was awesome. It was hosted by the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University this April 20th through the 22nd. Definitely the conference of a lifetime if you're into humanism. At the same time that the Harvard conference was going on, the Secular Student Alliance hosted a joint conference on student activist training. Jess and I were presenters there. We were talking about podcasting, web promotion, media relations, and newfangled technology.
I don't know about you, Duncan, but it was my first time being a seasoned veteran at anything compared to the students.
Yes.
So during the conference, the H&N podcast recording team, i.e. Duncan, our boss, Matt Cherry, and me, were busy recording as many interviews with humanists from all around the world. It's really exciting. Mm-hmm. So in the following months, we're going to be releasing some of our face-to-face interviews with the likes of Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist E.O. Wilson, celebrity law professor Alan Dershowitz.
Whom I grabbed on the staircase at Harvard.
Rather stalker-like, yes. Folk singer-songwriter Dara Williams, Rabbi Sherwin Wein, who is the founder of Humanistic Judaism.
We also interviewed humanist group leaders from all over the world, Quebec, Sweden.
Let's not forget that sexy Irish accent.
Oh, yes, we did get an Irish accent on tape from Brendan. We should probably play that bumper this show.
Yep.
So you get to hear Brendan's wonderful Irish brogue. On this program, however, we will be playing our exclusive interview with acclaimed novelist Salman Rushdie, which we recorded on Saturday during the conference, and which I've been bragging about to all of my literary-type friends out there.
This was Duncan's finest hour, folks.
I was a little starstruck. We got a chance to ask, it was a short interview, we'll play it at the end of the show. We got a chance to ask Rushdie for his thoughts on organized humanism and the relationship between fiction and humanism. I tried to ask him some questions that he doesn't usually get asked. Before our exclusive interview with Rushdie, we'll play some selected recordings from the award ceremony on Friday, April 20th, during which Rushdie received the Outstanding Lifetime Achievement Award in Cultural Humanism, which was presented by humanist chaplain Greg Epstein on behalf of the Humanist Chaplaincy of Harvard University.
And you heard from Greg last month in his interview with Duncan on our podcast.
The ceremony took place in the Memorial Chapel at Harvard Yard. These recordings are provided to the Humanist Network News podcast courtesy of the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy and are made possible in part by funding from the Institute for Humanist Studies. That's my legal language, and I'm now done reading it, so let's move on.
That's right. So we're going to try and put you there just as we were on Friday night. We were all excited to see Rushdie, and we got to hear from some wonderful people beforehand. Speaking of those wonderful people, Steven Pinker is a Harvard Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology. He was also named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World in 2004.
Jess was number 101 on that list, so she didn't quite make it.
Yeah, not, almost. The American Humanist Association also named Pinker the 2006 Humanist of the Year. Also introducing Rushdie was Rebecca Goldstein, who is a MacArthur Fellow, a novelist, a philosopher, and also author of Betraying Spinoza, The Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity.
Here are Steven Pinker, Rebecca Goldstein, Steven Pinker's hair, during the ceremony introducing Salman Rushdie.
Thank you very much. I kind of feel like we're like the Sonny and Cher of humanism. And and I say that mindful of the fact that Cher always got the best lines. I'd like to welcome you to Harvard. I'd like to thank Greg Epstein for making this splendid event possible. And I'd like to begin with a question. Why am I here? Why are all of us here? In my case, I study the human mind, and in studying the human mind, I inevitably face the assumption, which almost everyone in the field shares, that the mind is a product of the brain, a biological organ, and that the brain was shaped by natural selection in the evolutionary process. That doesn't leave any room for some immaterial entity called the soul, a ghost in the machine. It doesn't leave much room for a narrative of the universe in which humans were put on Earth for a purpose, a moral purpose given by some animate entity which they are charged with carrying out. On the other hand, even though I am a materialist, as are most people who study the mind, I still feel that there is a place for meaning and purpose and something larger than ourselves. But when you have this set of beliefs, you can feel awfully lonely. I did not have many friends on the politically correct left, and I had even fewer friends on the religious right. And I was kind of feeling I can't be the only person who has this set of beliefs. They just seem so obvious. And then at some point, a few years ago, it occurred to me, I'm a humanist. That's who I'm. That's what I am. But even that can leave some grounds for disquiet, because after all, religion, traditional religions, they have the beautiful architecture, they have the great music, they have the terrific literature, and when you consider yourself a humanist, when you join the humanists, it's kind of like joining the chess club or Mensa or the astronomy club. And what was missing is some sense that this set of beliefs that nowadays we call humanism does have some gravitas, that it has an intellectual connection to important strands of Western and indeed Eastern thought as well. And this is a perfect opportunity for me to turn the lectern over to a person who has done so much to educate the world on at least one secular humanist, Spinoza, and I will turn it over to Rebecca Goldstein.
Thank you. It is indeed a tremendous thrill to be here and to do honor to Salman Rushdie and to this movement that I too, sometime in my adulthood, realized that I was part of. And it does, Steve, it does have a great and glorious tradition. It's a tradition going back very, very far. They farther than the word secular humanism or cultural humanism, but to a certain extent, these values of free inquiry and intellectual honesty, human dignity, tolerance, and universalism are as old as philosophy, Eastern and Western philosophy. So yes, Spinoza is, I like to call him, the first modern secular humanist, but it goes back even further. It really goes back to Plato.
This is Brendan Sheeran. I'm a director of the Humanist Association of Ireland, and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. Next, we're going to play some music that was recorded live during the ceremony.
Gaflet içinde geldi güz ayları, erdi baharım, geçirdim günümü. Gaflet içinde ben yana yana, gaflet içinde geçirdim günümü.
We're going to learn more about this music later when we play some more of it throughout the show. But right now, it's time to hear some recordings of what Salman Rushdie had to say about accepting the Outstanding Lifetime Achievement Award in Cultural Humanism. So Duncan, since we're only going to be playing selections from that night, give the audience some context. Why was he chosen for this award?
Right. Well, Salman Rushdie is probably most famous for the controversy that followed the publication of his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses, which came out in 1988. And that situation is kind of like the Muhammad cartoon controversy recently. In the novel, it's a work of fiction, Rushdie explores sort of this episode that was claimed to have happened during the Prophet Muhammad's life, but it's controversy. And so the Satanic Verses was considered by many to be blasphemous against the religion of Islam, and it was banned in several countries. They took it up a notch in 1989 when Iranian leader Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa calling for the murder of Rushdie for writing this novel. And this isn't just hot air. The British government took this threat very seriously, and Rushdie had to go into hiding for several years. So when humanists and freethinkers talk about Rushdie, they usually focus on, you know, Rushdie standing up against murderous religious intolerance. I don't think that's really what the Award for Cultural Humanism is about, though. See, Rushdie's writing style is called magical realism, and Rushdie himself talks about his life moving between countries and cultures, religions and nationalities, etc. And a lot of Rushdie's characters slip between different cultures, and their experiences kind of drift through the real and the surreal. I imagine the whole fatwa incident was very surreal for Rushdie. And Matt Cherry pointed out in the H&N e-zine last week that, you know, the journeys that Rushdie's characters bring us on, they all reveal the same universal characteristics of the human condition. And Matt described those as the search for love and community and understanding as we create our own meaning in a universe without purpose.
And as he presented the Outstanding Lifetime Achievement Award in Cultural Humanism to Salman Rushdie, humanist chaplain Greg Epstein read aloud the words which appear on the award itself. Without words, without writing, and without books, there would be no history. There could be no concept of humanity. And that's by Hermann Hesse. Greg Epstein then thanked Rushdie for giving us a concept of humanity.
Here's Salman Rushdie accepting the award.
Thank you. And it feels a little bit like being dead. only nicer. I mean, thank you very much for this. It's really a little overwhelming. And thank you all for coming to this little Black Sabbath. I'm not sure that you're allowed to hold Walpurgisnacht in a church, but, you know, until they stop us, just go ahead. I should say, before I say anything else, that it's the second time in the last month or so that I've had the privilege of sharing a platform with Steven Pinker, and I'm exactly that kind of humanist. and just the one to mention about Spinoza, that in a way, I was brought to Spinoza through the work of P.G. Woodhouse. because not many of you may know that Spinoza is the favorite philosopher of Jeeves. in fact, that Jeeves attributes his intelligence to the eating of fish and the reading of Spinoza. I mean, in that order, I suspect. But and my view is if he's good enough for Jeeves, he's good enough for me. It is a little strange, I confess, to be congratulated and honored for doing what just seems, as Stephen was saying, what just seems completely natural and sensible. I was fortunate to grow up in a family that was relatively free of religion, or at least my immediate parents. Other members of my family were much more religious, but my father wasn't, and my mother wasn't really, although in her old age she developed some worrying tendencies. But I thought of them like arthritis. which she also had. But most of my life, I was brought up really happily free of religion. There was a moment in our childhood, my three sisters and I, when my parents suddenly felt a bit guilty and thought they should do something about religious instruction. So they hired a Maulvi, a Muslim priest, to come round to the house to inculcate the stuff into us. And my sisters, who were much more mischievous than I, started making fun of him. And he complained to my parents, who rather courageously, I thought, rather wonderfully, took my sister's side and decided that the teacher didn't need to come anymore. That was it, as far as religious instruction was concerned. And since then, I've come to appreciate that as a gift. I mean, at the time, it seemed, as I say, it seemed completely normal. And I mean, I grew up in a community in Bombay, in our immediate neighborhood, were people of every conceivable religion and no religion. I mean, there were children of Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, Sikh, Parsi, and a few, like my family, unbelieving households. And we all simply agreed to, it somehow cancelled, they all cancelled each other out, except that we all decided that what we would do is have each other's holidays as well as our own. So so what it meant to us was more holidays. And this led me in later life to wonder, where was the holiday for people who didn't believe in God? The schools my children went to would say with great pride how they would, in a spirit of ecumenicism, would observe the religious holidays of all these different religions. And I would say, but where's the one for the unbelievers? You know, where is the Kwanzaa for the atheists? Surely we could make one of those up. Atheismus. We were, Stephen and I were inventing this backstage. So I proposed that. Maybe this is it. Maybe that's what this weekend is. It's atheismus. Yes. Amen or similar. But I do remember, speaking specifically of humanism, a moment when I was a university student at Cambridge, and the most popular lecturer at Cambridge was in fact nothing to do with my subject, which was history. It was an elderly, heavily Mittel-European accented architectural professor called Nikolaus Pevsner, who had done a big study of the churches of England and Europe. And his lectures, because he was a mesmeric lecturer, would be packed every week with thousands of people literally hanging from the rafters. You had to get there an hour early to get a place, which was not always the case in college lectures. And I always remembered a moment when he explained with much flamboyant arm waving the difference between the Gothic and the Renaissance principle of architecture. And he said in the Gothic cathedral, he said, the eye is led forward towards the altar and upwards towards God. So the movement is this.
For those of you in Radioland, Rushdie is doing a sweeping movement with his hands out in front of him, ending in what looks like a Nazi salute.
No, he didn't mean that. That's the Mel Brooks version. Springtime for Pevsner. Yeah, exactly. But he then said he did to different. He then said in the Renaissance church, made on an X shape, it looks like a cross, but in fact, the meaning of this is that the only way you can experience the church is for a human being to stand at the center. And he said what it does is instead of making this movement towards God, it makes a movement towards man. And as a description of just not architecture, but of a movement from the period of the Gothic into the period of the Renaissance, movement away from the worship of God to the placing of man at the center of the story, I thought it was an unforgettable image. And here I am, 40 years later, repeating that image to you because I've never lost it. And it seems to me to have informed a lot of what I've subsequently thought. In the words of Pope, know then thyself and think not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man. And for a novelist, of course, that's, if you don't do that, you're not doing anything. The great thing about the novel as a form is that it can never, even the most abstract fiction, can never entirely lose the human scale. If you do not have at the center of a work of literature a thing the size of a human being around which everything else is woven, then you don't have literature. You have something else. And so I think it almost follows from trying to be a novelist that you would find yourself involved with the ideas of humanism. And so for me, as I say, it's just come with the territory. But thank you for this honor, which really I do feel slightly overwhelmed by. It's, people like being praised, but sort of in their absence. I mean, I just like to hope that people would say this when I wasn't there. but I guess I'll never know. Bertrand Russell had the experience, actually. Bertrand Russell was in China at one point and became very ill and was hospitalized. And technology being worse then than it is now, the Chinese whispers, so to speak, arrived back in England, and his death was announced. And all the newspapers ran his obituary. And they were brought to him in his hospital bed in China, so he was able to read what people really thought of him, and then get even. anyway, enough of that. I'm going to read you for a little while from my last novel, Shalimar the Clown, which is a novel at its heart about the story of what's happened in Kashmir in the last half century or so, a place where there's been a great clash of between an old, peaceful, mystical way of life and the new violence of the world, both military and terrorist.
Okay, listeners, Salman Rushdie gave an amazing reading of two excerpts from his novel, Shalimar the Clown. We don't have time to play those in the podcast, but you can buy the book and you can read those passages yourself. You can read the whole book. So what we want to do is we want to bring you the audio that you won't get a chance to hear. However, just to give you a taste for what that reading was like, here's a very brief excerpt of Rushdie's reading.
This is Max, the ambassador, has recently arrived in India to take up his post and wants to go to Kashmir, which is the great flashpoint. He wants to go and see it for himself. When he expressed a desire to go immediately to Kashmir, the Indian Home Minister, Nanda, objected strongly. The security concerns were too great. His safety couldn't be guaranteed. Then, for the first time in his life, Max Ophuls exercised the power of the United States of America. The nature of overwhelming might, he would later write in his book, The Man of Power, is such that the powerful man does not need to allude to his power. The fact of it is present in everyone's consciousness. Thus, power does its work by stealth, and the powerful can subsequently deny that their strength was ever used at all. Within hours, Nanda was overruled by the Prime Minister's office, and the visit to Kashmir was green-lit.
Next, we're going to play some portions of the question and answer session that followed Rushdie's reading. But first, here's Harvard's humanist chaplain, Greg Epstein, explaining the music that we've been listening to.
This is incredible Turkish music that we chose because, now, to some of you may have uneducated ears the way that I do, and this may sound to you in the way that unfortunately it sounds to me because I'm not an expert, like the music of a mosque. But it isn't. It's not mosque music. These are the Turkish troubadours. This is the music of the Turkish troubadours. This is music that was written in the 19th century at the dawn of modernization, and it was music that is about human creativity. They're telling stories in this music that are critical of the gods. And yet, it has that ring to us, for many of us at least, of the music of the mosque. Isn't that amazing? That it's secular creativity.
Uzun ince bir yoldayım. Gidiyorum gündüz gece.
Here are some of the questions that audience members asked Salman Rushdie and his responses.
What is the status of the fatwa against you? Is it still out there, or have you had any problems or with
security?
No,
it's kind of. It's. I'm not happy to say it's kind of long gone, really. I mean, it's been so. I mean, you don't look dangerous to me.
What is your favorite book?
What is my favorite book? You mean of any, by anybody or by me?
By any.
Oh, I see.
by anybody.
Oh, okay. That's, you know, it's difficult. I mean, it's easy to say what are your favorite 100 books, but it's quite difficult to choose one. And it also depends what day of the week it is and what you had for lunch. You know? But I don't know, the question of the Desert Island book, you know, when I've been asked that question, I tend to cheat and ask for the Arabian Nights, you know, which is like having 12 books in one. But I think the reason I say that is because I was, a lot of the way in which I think about writing was shaped by growing up in a culture, in the culture of the wonderful tale, you know, in the culture in which you know that stories are not true, you know, that stories are make-believe, and that's why it is possible for carpets to fly, you know, and that the truth of stories, the truth of literature, is another kind of truth. It's a felt emotional truth, not a documentary, journalistic, reportage truth, and the Arabian Nights stories are wonderful exemplars of that, so I think maybe that.
You and I, and most of us here, will recognize that God is a fictional character. As a fictional character, and of course there are various gods, let's take the one with a capital G, is he a good character? Is it an interesting character?
Yeah. No, I don't like him very much, actually. I mean, speaking purely in fictional terms, yeah. I much prefer the polytheistic gods to the solo gods, you know, because the great thing about the pantheons, you know, whether it's the Greek gods or the Roman gods or the Norse gods or the Hindu gods, is that they don't behave well, you know, that they're kind of mean-spirited and vengeful, and their normal technique of lovemaking is rape. there's not a lot of foreplay, you know. And they're angry, and they take sides, and they bully people, and they're vain, and so on and so on. And they are great characters, you know. And what is even better about them is that they don't ask you to do like they do. You know, they don't set themselves up as moral exemplars. You know, they're simply ourselves writ large, with the faults magnified, and so on. And all they ask is to be worshipped, which, hey, you know, what's wrong with that? So I prefer, I mean, on the whole, I prefer the polytheistic gods. The monotheisms produce these, you know, these less interesting characters.
Just one supplementary. What do you think of the writer?
Who wrote the god?
Who wrote the god?
Well, I mean, you know, the Old Testament is, it's a mixed bag, isn't it? I mean, there is some extraordinary writing in it. I mean, the book of Job, for example, I mean, and which people even now, even scholars accept that that was actually a work of fiction that got put into the Old Testament. It was actually written as a work of fiction. that even its author knew it was a work of fiction. You know, I think that's quite good. I know, and again, it depends which translation. I mean, I'm a great fan of the King James Bible, and I think it is actually very, very astonishing just in its language. You know? So whoever wrote that, the authors of the King James Bible, they were good writers.
I would like to know what advice would you give to an aspiring writer, and how would you describe your writing process?
Yeah. Well, this thing about advice to aspiring writers, my real answer is, if you need the advice, don't do it. I mean, because everybody I've ever known who really was a writer had some real determination, some fire burning inside them, you know, that they needed to, that forced them to do it, you know, and that they didn't have an option. You know, they had to be a writer because they couldn't not be a writer. And I think what you look for, I mean, I get my share of books by new writers sent to me. And I think what you look for is, you don't look for necessarily for a completely achieved work. You know, you're not looking for a masterpiece. I think it's kind of a mistake to look for that. I mean, you look for something, you haven't heard before. You look for, you know, you look for a relationship with language or a relationship with human beings or with a place or just something that you haven't heard, something that feels fresh. And if that's there, then the other stuff probably will show up. But most of all, what it needs is the determination to do it. You know, and I mean, in my own case, I left college in 1968. Midnight's Children was published in 1981. That was, you know, 12 and a half years of failure without any guarantee of success. And if somebody were to ask me now if I would spend a dozen years of my life doing something without any guarantee that I'd ever do well at it, I would think they were mad. But that's, over and over again, the story of young writers, you know, that they actually have that thing in them which prevents them from giving up and which in the end makes them writers, if they have it. What was the other question? You had another question, but I can't remember it.
Oh, it was just about your...
Oh, writing process. No, I do it like a job. I get up in the morning, I do a day's work, then I go out to dinner.
The question is, the conference here is called the New Humanism. There's something that's come about recently called a New Atheism that's been characterized by people like Dawkins, Sam Harris, and a new book that's about to come out by your friend Hitchens. I wonder what you think about this new atheism, which is much more aggressive and kind of anti-religious than perhaps some humanists would like to acknowledge. Mm.
Well, Christopher Hitchens is my friend. That doesn't mean I agree with him. Let me just say that. And there's a moment when your friends begin to form divergent opinions, when you have to decide whether they're going to be your friends or not. And in the end, you know, I've known him too long and I love him too much that I can disagree with everything he says and he's still my friend. So, and increasingly, I do disagree with everything he says, as do most of his friends. So, you know, I don't mind it as much as all that. I mean, I think, you know, for instance, a book like Sam Harris's book, I mean, like The End of Faith, which is the only thing of his I've read, it's a bit tabloidy. It makes these very assertive, you know, 6-inch headline statements, and you feel as if the whole thing has been set in exclamation marks, you know, and it, you can't help feeling that a little nuance wouldn't hurt, you know. But on the other hand, in these extremely pusillanimous, cowardly days, it is wonderful to hear somebody just standing up and saying, what the hell, I hate this stuff, you know? And even if you don't always agree with him, it's great that he feels that he can say it, you know? And because right now, self-censorship is everywhere, and it's one of the scariest forces around.
Mr. Rushdie, it's a pleasure. My question is about the Satanic Verses. I understand that it is impacted in some way by The Master and Margarita, is that right?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the role of the narrator in the Satanic Verses and what you took from Bulgakov's novel and where you got some of the other ideas for that piece.
Well, it's very strange in retrospect that, yes, it's quite true that The Master and Margarita was a novel that was very helpful to me in trying to put together the rather complicated structure of the Satanic Verses, because he tries to do something not dissimilar in terms of interweaving narratives and also in terms of offering a variant version of a great world religion. I mean, in the case of Bulgakov's novel, Christianity, the story of Jesus from the point of view of Pontius Pilate. And there's also a certain amount of devil stuff in Bulgakov. I mean, actually the funniest stuff in the novel is the devil visiting Moscow and creating havoc. I like the devil's sidekicks a lot. And the devil has that cat, you know, the cat with the 6 guns who could shoot the pips out of the ace of spades. I want that cat, you know. And he has that other...
I don't want to be anywhere near that cat.
No, well, that's probably wise. He has the friend, he has the other sidekick who turns sideways and disappears, you know, the ultimate two-dimensional man, the greatest two-dimensional character in literature. So I think, yes, I learned a lot of those things about interweaving narration and about the religious stuff. But mostly, I think, the thing that wonderful novel showed me was a question of tone of voice. You know, the fact that it's pitched on the edge and sometimes over the edge of comedy. in that even though what it's talking about is extremely profound and often metaphysical and so on, its tone of voice is relentlessly comic. People float, you know, sort of landladies float sideways through the air like Chagall paintings, you know. And I thought there was a great clue there, that, you know, if you're going to write about this kind of material, do not sound ponderous and reverent, you know, sound somehow light. And it is kind of really an irony, I think, looking back, that what happened to The Master and Margarita was so similar to what happened to the Satanic Verses. You know, that it too had a lot of trouble. And in fact, there wasn't, as I understand, there wasn't an unexpurgated good translation of The Master and Margarita, publication of The Master and Margarita available in Russian until after 1989. That throughout the communist period, it was a book which was essentially in samizdat, or published in very bowdlerized and expurgated versions. Yeah, I mean, I think it is a book that, oddly, did inspire me a lot. I remember at the time that I was writing The Satanic Verses, many people would say to me that it was kind of crazy to write this book which had so many stories, which were separate stories weaving into each other because it would be incomprehensible and unreadable, and etc. And actually, if I recall, when the book came out, the word unreadable was occasionally applied to it. Deeply unjustly. But it was applied to it. But you see, now I think every time you go to the movies, that's how they go. You know, every movie you go to has got six plots that don't have anything to do with each other, weaving in and out. You know, whether it's, you know, Crash or Babel or Amoris Peros or whatever it is, it's become like a new convention. And the thing that I did then would seem commonplace now. But back in the late 80s, it seemed radical. And Bulgakov was comforting because it showed me that at least somebody had done it before, you know, and therefore maybe I could get away with it. But the main thing of that book was to do with that keeping it on that edge of comedy fantasy, you know, and not allowing it to sort of crash into the dreadful pit of seriousness. I mean, one of the things not often said about the Satanic Verses is that it's quite funny. But it is. You know, trust me. Don't trust the Ayatollah Khomeini. Trust me.
Thank you.
I'm interested in the idea of atheismus. If it was worth coming here just for that one idea tonight, that's okay. Just a fabulous idea.
What would we do,
though? But it makes me think about the whole idea of defining ourselves by what we do not believe in versus defining ourselves by what we believe in. Mm. And I am wondering if you could comment on the idea of calling ourselves atheists versus humanists or naturalists, people who are fully included in the natural world. And I would also love it if you could comment on the values of the Enlightenment and whether you're optimistic about an Enlightenment period within the Islamic world.
Yes. Is that all?
In 2 minutes or less.
I think yes, you're right that these are all these labels are in some way only partial labels, but I do think that the question of origins and the question of ethics, which are the two big things which lead people to religion, are things which, for me, are not answered by religion. You know, and I look for answers to both those questions away from the convention of religion. You know, I don't believe in any of the stories, the religious stories of the origin of the universe, and I don't look to priests for my moral answers. You know, and so, in that sense, I suppose it is a little bit of a definition against, because it's also not belief in a way. It's not belief. So it's difficult to define it as another kind of belief. What was the other bit? Oh yeah, the Enlightenment value. Enlightenment in Islam. Well, yes. I mean, I think there is much enlightened thought in Islam, you know, and always has been, and I think is now, which we don't hear about because we hear the loud voices, you know, and At the same time, it's very important to recognize that those voices have all the momentum just now, and that the other way of being has been for the last 20, 30 years in considerable retreat. Whether that can change again, I mean, of course, I hope so, you know, but don't hold your breath. Last question. Make it a good one.
Well, I'm,
no pressure.
I'm sorry, this might be a little simple-minded compared to some of the other questions, but I find it's what I really want to know.
Yeah.
The Satanic Verses and the fatwa and the way it disrupted your whole life for so many years, would you do it again?
I'd prefer not to. I mean, to quote Bartleby, I have no problem with the book. It seems to me, I feel as good about it as I feel about any of my books, which means some days very good and some days not very good. But I also feel happy that now that we're here, rather than in the kind of heat of the storm, that people are finally getting to read it like a book, you know, and kind of discovering that it's funny, you know, for example. And now it's actually having, at last, the ordinary life of a novel, which is that some people like it a lot, some people like it a bit, some people don't like it much, some people don't like it at all, and all of that is fine. That's what happens to books. You know, but for a long time, what happened to the Satanic Verses was not what happens to books. And it's for a long time, it felt to me like the only language that was felt improper to discuss the matter in was the language of literature. You know, you could talk about it theologically or politically or, you know, multiculturally, or you could use a whole range of sort of intellectual structures to look at what was happening, you know, sociological, political, religious structures. But you couldn't talk about it as a book. That seemed like indulgence, you know, or not serious. And it seemed the worst thing to me, it seemed to be to spend 5 years writing a novel, and then the only thing that nobody will do is talk about what kind of a novel it is. And so I feel happy to have, if nothing else, to have managed to bring that book to the point at which people can read it as a book and decide what, and see what they think. You know, and I hope you like it. Thank you very much. That's great. Thank you.
On Saturday at the conference, Rushy joined a panel discussion on Abrahamic humanism at the Hyatt Regency Cambridge Hotel. Rushdie spoke about humanistic Islam.
Okay, after this panel, I had made arrangements with Salman Rushdie to interview him for the H&N podcast, and the panel was running late. And here I am, I've got like what I consider the interview of a lifetime, and it's slipping between my fingers because I know that Rushdie has to leave immediately after lunch, which is right after the discussion. So I grabbed Matt Cherry, executive director of the Institute, and we both took other, you know, both sides of the auditorium. We were sort of sneaking up both sides and just getting ready to pounce on Rushdie afterwards. And I basically told Matt, like, you know, if he turns to the left, you got him. If he turns to the right, I got him. Like, we're not letting him get out of here without this interview. And immediately after he finished, you know, people just running up, like, getting, oh, can I have your autograph, all this stuff. And we just, Mr. Rushdie, will you come with us, please? And we whisked him away to the H&N podcast recording room at the New Humanism Conference. So here is the long-awaited interview with Salman Rushdie, Matt Cherry, and me, Jess Constantine on sound. Salman Rushdie, we are here at the New Humanist Conference, sponsored by the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy. And last night you quipped that we were having a little Black Sabbath in the Memorial Chapel at Harvard. I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the relationship between humanist thought, and organized humanism. Do you feel that this is the direction that humanist thought is moving towards, or what is the relationship between the two?
But it's been interesting for me because I've not really been very involved in this kind of organized humanistic project. I think it's pretty interesting. I think it's a little in its infancy, you know, and I think one needs to work out, in a way, how to make it more itself and less an echo of religious procedures.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean? So, but I think that's a development issue. I think that'll just emerge gradually.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Steven Pinker said yesterday was very much true of me as well, that for a long time, I didn't know which group I belonged to. I just knew all the groups I didn't belong to. So in that sense, it's a place to hang your hat. You know, you can say, okay, this does represent, broadly speaking, what I think.
Mm-hmm. That's an amazingly common reaction. I've worked as a professional humanist for about 15 years, and I got involved because I discovered the humanist movement after doing a degree in philosophy and being non-religious all my life. And I thought, that's me. And then I thought, what's wrong with these guys? I've never heard of them. And that's me. I could have been so involved.
Yeah, I've been working on a book which takes place in part in the Renaissance in Italy, and so I've been actually studying the origins of Renaissance humanist thought. You know, so and again, it shows that these ideas are not by any means, they didn't just show up. You know, they've been very much at the heart of Western culture. And as Amartya Sen said in his presentation this morning, they're also very close to the heart of Eastern culture and have been around for literally thousands of years. So it's a question of how to give them salience in this world of you know, noisy, competing religions. And that's, I guess to do that, you do have to organize in some way.
But how do we organize a group of people who almost by their own identity say, I'm not a joiner? How do we get them to join
it
a group?
No, it's very difficult. And I think speaking as a novelist, I've always been of the persuasion that didn't like joining clubs. You know, I mean, there are artists who like to be part of movements, you know, and there are others who prefer to be lone wolves, you know, and I've always been of that persuasion. So I do, I worry myself about the degree to which I could ever join anything, you know. Yes, I think that's one of the reasons for the weakness of the voice, is that the people involved are all too individualistic.
Yeah. You mentioned last night that fiction is a way to reveal certain truths. What is the role of art and fiction in humanist thought as far as revealing certain truths?
Well, I just think, you know, the question of the human being is the heart of the art of literature. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. You know, if you don't want to discuss that question or to explore that inexhaustible question, you know, don't write novels. Because one can write nonfiction, which is about a very wide range of things, mm-hmm. Other than human nature. Mm-hmm. You know, but the novel is about human nature. Mm-hmm. And so it, like all humanistic thought, the novel as a form places the human being at the center.
Yeah. Now, I understand that you've been keeping a journal of your life experiences.
I used to. I haven't done so. Yes, I did so during the bad old days, yeah. Because there was a lot going on that I wanted to have a way of remembering it.
Right. Salman Rushdie, I have one final question for you. I know you have to go. Humanist Network News publishes what we think is the only advice column for humanists, questions about life as a humanist. And I'm wondering if you have a question for our sweet reason, humanist advice columnist. Any issues that you might want to ask about?
You mean the kind of agony aunt?
Yes, an agony aunt.
Well, I think one of the problems that I've felt is the lack of a language in which to speak about these things, because religious language is so highly developed and has had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years to establish itself. And non-religious language sometimes feels impoverished. And the question is, where do we go to develop that language? You know, that how do we get the right words? You know, for instance, if you're a person who doesn't believe in an afterlife, a word like the soul would seem to have no meaning. Right. You know, and yet many of us, whether or not we believe in paradise or a god or an immortal side to ourselves, understand what we mean by the soul. So the question is how to create a language that works. Ask your agony aunt that.
We will. Okay. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News podcast. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
Maureen Matsumura, also known as Sweet Reason, is going to be answering Salman Rushdie's question for her next audio, Sweet Reason, which will be released with the next H&N audio podcast on May 23rd.
That's right, listeners. just like in the heydays of radio drama, we're going to leave you hanging on the edge of a cliff. So you're going to have to tune into the next H&N podcast to hear Maleen's answer to Salman Rushdie's question.
Insert spooky, suspenseful music here.
Exactly.
If you have some advice for Salman Rushdie, or if you'd like to comment on anything else related to this show, please feel free to give us a call at the H&N listener comment line, 206-339-4168.
Jess, I got to give a special thanks to Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, for setting us up with that recording room during the conference.
That was a sweet spot.
It was awesome. Thank you very much, Greg Epstein.
And if you'd like to learn more about the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard, visit harvardhumanist.org. To listen to Greg talk about his work at the humanist chaplaincy, check out our podcast, episode number 17, on our website, humaniststudies.org/podcast.
Believe it or not, Salman Rushdie was just one of several celebrity humanists that we had the opportunity to interview personally during the New Humanism Conference. We're going to be releasing those interviews on podcasts to come. So here's a little audio montage that Jess put together for us to give you a little taste of what's to come.
First is a soundbite from Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist E.O. Wilson.
In promoting the new humanism as not an alternative but a complementary approach to the new atheism, I go out of my way to avoid conflict up front by saying at some length, with due respect, then asking for help. There is no way that's better than asking for help to get the friendship of a person. And I do like to think that while the military wing, our fellow humanists, will gain a few converts, particularly those that were very uncertain, I think I'm much more likely to get the ear of the faith community and actually persuade many more people to give serious consideration to what scientists are finding and what humanists, the new humanist, all the inclusive humanists, are trying to say.
Here's celebrity Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz.
Well, there are a lot of dirty words these days. Liberal's a dirty word. Secular's a dirty word. Humanist is a dirty word. Faith has become a powerful, powerful word. And those of us on the secular side shouldn't demean other people's faith, and they shouldn't demean our reason. It's very important that we make the positive case for humanism and for human-centered morality.
Singer-songwriter Dar Williams.
I followed the various agendi of what we think is going to make the planet sustainable for the future.
And Rabbi Sherwin Wein, founder of the Humanistic Judaism Movement.
WASPs approach humanism differently because they're not quite sure they want to be bossed by God anyway. So, I mean, but Jews approach it from their experience. And their experience is that their culture was taken over by the clergy for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the clergy kept telling them that they were the chosen of God and were being protected. Only they were what? Getting hit over the head all the time. So what that produces is something called skepticism.
We have an exciting announcement to share with our listeners. A Brief History of Disbelief, which is a documentary film about the history of atheism by British filmmaker Jonathan Miller, is going to air this side of the Atlantic after Friday, May 4th, on public television stations throughout the country. I say after May 4th because different public television stations throughout the country will be airing it at different times. You need to visit abriefhistoryofdisbelief.org to find local listings. Check out the Bill Moyers Journal on PBS this Friday, May 4th, to hear Jonathan Miller talk about his documentary.
Well, that just about wraps up this show, but we are going to end with one more surprise, so stay tuned. Please let us know your thoughts, either on humanism in general or this specific episode. Our listener comment line is 206-339-4168.
The use of our theme music was generously donated by singer-songwriter Holly Neer. You can listen to previous installments of the monthly Humanist Network News podcast and read transcripts and humaniststudies.org/podcast.
You can also read our weekly Humanist Network News e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We're going to take the show out with a live recording of Dar Williams performing When I Was a Boy at the New Humanism Conference. You'll hear my exclusive interview with Dar in the next H&N podcast on May 23rd. This clip is provided to us courtesy of the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard and is played with permission of Dar Williams.
I don't quite know how to summarize this experience of being here tonight, because it's really such an honor, and to hear such lucid and wonderful speakers has really been a real gift to me. So this is, I will also add, a very humble offering to the humanism movement. I won't forget when Peter Pan came to my house, took my hand. I said I was a boy, I'm glad he didn't check. I learned to fight. I lived a whole life in one night. We saved each other's lives out on the pirate deck. And I remember that night when leaving a late night with some friends, and I hear somebody tell me it's not safe, someone should help me. I need to find a nice man to walk me home. When I was a boy, scared the pants off of my mom, climbed what I could climb above. And I don't know how I survived. I guess I knew the tricks that all boys knew. She would like just a small boy on her bike riding topless. Yeah, I never care who saw. My neighbor came outside to say, get your shirt. I said, no way, it's the last time, I'm not breaking any law. And now I'm in this clothing store, and the signs say less is more. More that's tight means more to see. More for them, not more for me. That can help me climb a tree 10 seconds flat. When I was a boy, see that picture, that was me. Grass stained shirt and dusty knees. And I know things are gonna change. They got pills to sell, they got implants to put in, they got implants to remove. But I am not forgetting that I was a boy too. And like the woods where I would creep, but it's a secret I can't keep. Except when I'm tired, except when I'm being cut off guard. And had a lonesome, awful day. The conversation finds its way to catching fireflies out in the backyard. And so I tell the man I'm with about the other life I lived. And I say, now you're Top Gun, I have lost and you have won. And he says, oh no, can't you see? When I was a girl, my mom and I, we always talked. And I picked flowers everywhere that I walked. And I could always cry. Now even when I'm alone, I seldom do. Just like me.
The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism.
Thank you so much. Thank you.